This is Joe Leith speaking at the 1980 Cache Creek, Colorado conference.
Father, I admit that I am powerless and my life is unmanageable without your help and guidance. Dear God, I come to you today knowing that you can and will restore and renew me for my needs of the day, that you will restore my life to order and harmony. Since I am powerless and you are all powerful, I will make a decision to give you my life, my will, my thoughts, my desires, my ambitions. Father, I give you all of me, the good and the bad, all of my character defects and shortcomings, my selfishness, stubbornness, self-righteousness, self-centeredness, resentments, self-will. All of my defects I admit to you and give to you. I turn my loved ones over to you and the old idea that I can change them. I turn my problems over to you, knowing that you can work them out for the good of all concerned. Father, I humbly ask you to remove these shortcomings from me and make me aware of any others not known to me. If there is any change in God, you'll have to do it. Make me willing to be changed so that you can use me to be of service to you. Help me and keep me ever mindful of the people I have harmed. And Father, I am willing to make amends to them all. Dear God, teach me to watch for the sly little foxes that creep back into my life, the sins of my personality that harm you, myself, and others, that separate and cut me off from the sunshine of your spirit. And when I commit these errors, make me aware of them and help me to promptly admit it. Father, I am seeking to know you better, to love you more. I am seeking the knowledge of your will for me, and I am seeking the power to carry that out. This is my life, and this is my desire, to be in your presence, knowing that your grace is my sufficiency. Our loving Father, show me the way to one of your children today who is still suffering and does not know the way of your love, mercy, and forgiveness, that I might share with them that which has so freely been given to me. Prompt me to be ever mindful to continue to practice the principles of loving, giving, caring and sharing, surrendering, accepting and releasing, and gratefulness and honesty in all my affairs. Thank you for my life. I love you.
Thanks very much, Dean. That was beautiful.
He's an incredible man. He's touched a lot of people. The one thing I can say is that I think his timing in speaking is just absolutely flawless. And his humor is incredible. And every story he tells is not just a funny joke. It's a story, but they all have a message. I'd just like to give him the real welcome that I know you can give him. Joe from Tyler. Come on, Joe.
Somebody asked me one time what I thought about an introduction that a fellow gave me, and I said, well, it was long. I appreciate everything that Lou said. I think he kind of gets carried away with himself sometimes. He gave me a hell of a load to live up to here. My name's Joe, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here. And for those of you who are just dropped in, This is the regular Saturday night meeting of the Cache Creek AA group. Where in the hell did all of these people come from? I know what you do in the winter up here now. Sure. I'm strangely affected by what I have seen since I got up here and what has transpired here tonight in the recognition of the newcomer. Now, I've been around AA for a long time, as you saw over there, and you didn't have to see me stand up. You can just look at me and tell I've been somewhere for a long time. You didn't have to. But I don't know. I don't like old AA members, really. Only in time of years, that's all. I want to be a new AA member continuously and wake up every morning with that hope and anticipation that I had when I realized how helpless I was in the face of alcohol and what this program had to offer us. I want to forever have that newness about me that I can never forget. Our co-founder, Bill, I knew him rather well. I was with him many times, and you could not talk to that man for over 10 minutes until his conversation carried you outside that door to the person who was yet to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And this seems to be our great concern, and if we ever forget the fellow that's outside that door, we're dead in the water. And I've seen some good things happen in Cache Creek since I've been here. I saw a fellow by the name of Bert stand up and fondle the AA book as though he loved it with all his heart. And he talked about the principles of our recovery. I heard a gal named Margaret stand up this morning with the freshness of expectancy in this program and tell us about the tools of our recovery. So I'd be very presumptuous to come up here and tell you people how to operate your AA business. I'd be very presumptuous. I don't think there's much help needed up here, and somebody has been passing along a lot of good information in this area, believe you me, and I have the opportunity to see the whole United States and all of Canada every year nearly. And this is a beautiful area, believe me, for God's sake, it's a nice place to come. It far surpasses a lot of other places, because I suspect that now that bad information's killing more of us than alcohol is. I really believe that. And when you come to an area that is steeped in the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and work with the principles of our recovery, it is a thing to see. This sort of an operation will put 575 people in a building in Cache Creek tonight. This is what a good AA operation will do. So I want to record my thanks to all of you, because it's by your faith that has brought me as far as it has. I want to thank the committee, whoever they may be. They've been quite obscure. Nobody wants to take credit for inviting me up here. And I want to thank that fellow, the Chinese fellow who fed us here tonight with such great expeditiousness. I've always been suspect of Chinese restaurants. I don't eat on them anymore. because if you'll notice, if you ever look in the kitchen of a Chinese restaurant, they're always laughing. And being a suspicious alcoholic, I'd love to know what they're laughing about. You know, I won't eat with them anymore. I said it. They seem to me to look like they said, there he is. We'll give it to him. But they did it out in the open tonight. And I suspect that there's not 2% of the people here who could tell us what you had to eat. Well, let's don't be serious too long. I can't afford to be. I have swum around in all of the profundities that I'm going to, and we're going to visit with them folks that are less than a year sober tonight, the newcomers. These old fellers, there ain't a hell of a lot you can do for them anymore. I don't think Lysol and clean them up, you know. But we want to visit with the newcomer who looks at this thing and wonders what the vehicle of sobriety might be. And if need be, you can look at a guy that was the greatest skeptic on earth. I'd love to say to those people who won the big book that it's probably the most effective tool that you can have for your recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. The first 164 pages of it is about recovery, with the exception of about 5 pages it tells you about alcohol. And I get so sick of listening to people tell about alcoholism that I don't know what to do. Because when I came to AA, I was ready to quit. And I wanted to know about not drinking. I didn't want to know too much about drinking. And I get sick of people explaining to me about my unbalanced chromosomes and my deep-seated resentments and my constitutional inclinations and all of this other bullshit stuff. There I go, talking like a Methodist already, you know. If I tell you, how you find out if you're an alcoholic, the thing that will convince you most that you're an alcoholic: drink. That's the way you find out if you're an alcoholic. And alcohol should convince you that you're an alcoholic before you come to AA, because we're not very quick to come on the recommendation of Aunt Minnie and Uncle John. It takes a little booze, you know. I was at a seminar not so long ago, and one of them psychiatrists asked me, he said, what's the difference between an alcoholic and a non-alcoholic? And it took me by surprise. I couldn't quite answer. Finally, I said to him, you know, I believe that alcoholics drink more than non-alcoholics. And that's about as smart as I want to get in Alcoholics Anonymous. I never have met one of us who didn't drink. It's one of the requisites of coming in here. I didn't drink. But Alcoholics Anonymous has got a new face all over the world. Now, there's so many of us and there's so many people coming that we've grown quite fashionable. AA's rather fashionable in some areas. We used to worry about the stigma on alcoholism. We don't anymore. The biggest problem we got now is keeping out the social climbers. And but there is still somewhat of a stigma on alcoholism, in case you didn't know it. It's not completely extinct. The non-alcoholic will never understand why we take that drink repetitively. You can never explain it to them. There's a barrier there that we cannot surmount. But there is still a stigma, and I'll give you a good example of it. I have a nephew in Dallas, Texas, who is a psychiatrist. And then I have another nephew in San Francisco who's a homosexual. And you know my people brag on them more than they do on me, and I'm an alcoholic. Sure they do. But, you know, the newcomer, the sophisticated people that we get now, you know, the fellas that didn't, not old Last Gaspers like the first tenor in the Mission over here that you're looking at. They come in and they say, I need to identify with somebody. You've heard that, haven't you? You can't identify. I can identify with anybody. Man, woman, or child, white, green, or yellow, that ever took a drink against his own will. I can do that. But if it is difficult for you to identify, we'll see tonight if we cannot help you do that. Years ago, in General Service, they had a pamphlet called The 44 Questions. You remember that, don't you? They were little innocuous questions that didn't quite seem to fit my particular case of alcoholism. Oh, you know, little questions like, did your boss give you that look today? Or did you drink a little too much or gargle with a little too much Laboris? Little innocuous questions like that, and they didn't do anything for me. I wasn't that kind of a drunk. Now, I have contrived some questions here, which I will ask to you, and maybe we can have a little better luck in identification. Have you ever had the roof of your mouth sunburned? Have you ever had a malfunction of the zipper? They used to call me Rusty. Have you ever been arrested while in jail? Have you ever been run over by your own car while driving? Have you ever woke up with a circus midget in bed with you? Did you hear about that midget that got thrown out of the nudist colony because he was going around getting his nose in everybody's business? For God's sake. Have you ever been caught in your own burglar alarm? Have you ever been so nervous that you could lay in bed at night and listen to your hair grow? As a psychiatrist would say, I believe we're getting a little rapport here, you know, for God's sake. Have you ever done the Tennessee Waltz in a straitjacket? Uh, Have you ever been bitten by your own watchdog? You know, for sake. Here's a good one. Has your Al-Anon ever dropped a hot electric cord in the bathtub with you? I guess we've had about it. Well, here's the one that will separate the men from the boys. Have you ever woke up in the morning feeling rather delicately and lose your glasses and wash your teeth with Preparation A? That'll give you a pucker. From the response I get out of you people, I suspect there are some of you who are ready for us. I do. I think you are. And I think this is where Alcoholics Anonymous becomes so effective, as in the identification, and not so much in the identification as in the understanding. And I think that if there is one word that makes the society function, it is the fact that we understand one another. And I think the poor alcoholic sinks off into the shell, and alcoholism slips up on us. I don't believe I set out deliberately to be the village drunk. I didn't say one day I'm going to lie helpless under the bridge. I didn't set out to do that. This thing sneaks up upon us, and the alcoholic goes further and further, and he cannot see, and he cannot hear, and he's not aware. Are we being evicted? Yes? Am I? I've got my hearing aid turned off.
Better.
Can you hear now? I was afraid this thing was rattling here. I'm a good example of prayer in AA. Don't pray for something unless you want it. I said one day, I'm tired of listening to all this gossip that's going on around AA. And 2 weeks later, I was struck deaf. So I wear this hearing aid up here, but I've got it turned out. Sometimes it'll affect this thing. Is that doing better? Well, we'll get on with it. Moving right along now. But the alcoholic is a strange sort of an animal, and he cannot see until the last one. He's the last one to know about his helplessness. And he withers away and grows into a shell, and nobody can get close to him. And he unconsciously or unintentionally brings down upon himself all of the humiliations and all of the indignities that can befall a man of any description. I've been asked to tell this story, and it's rather befitting, I think, of what an alcoholic feels like and how he responds and what he cannot see.
Are we doing all right?
I get one of these. Is this the house mic? Oh, I didn't know that. I was preaching into this one. Yeah. These things, you get get a high-powered speaker like me up here and give him a damn $3.50 microphone. Some bookkeeper with a pocket knife running around sticking holes in it all the time. I forgot where I was. But the alcoholic is completely oblivious to what goes on outside of him. He does not feel these things, and the shell grows so thick, I think you've ruined it. Amen. With the assistance of the higher power and maybe eliminating these engineers, I will attempt to tell this little story, and it has to do with some of my wife's cats. I've been asked to tell it. Years ago, I lived in a little town called Goose Creek, Texas. If you look on the map now, you will not be able to find Goose Creek. It's not there anymore. I don't know whether I had anything to do with it or not, but I was working and my wife left me and went up into Illinois to help her sister have a baby. And while she was gone, I got fired, which was not very unusual for me. I was not a long-term employee for anybody. So I got fired, and the process in those days, and I know none of you have ever done this, is when you got booted, I always went home to Mama. Mama had a good purse, she had a good home, a nice place to sober up, and it was a good place to start. So I loaded up the car and put my wife's two cats in the back on a little mattress and headed home for Mama, which was some 300 miles from Goose Creek. And I left late in the afternoon. It was a cool afternoon, rather misty, just a beautiful evening to meditate. And as I drove through the outskirts of Houston, I saw a sign at one of the bars that said, 3 pints for the price of 2. And never being one to pass up a bargain, I bought the 3 pints for the price of 2 and then turned north to go towards Tyler. It was beginning to rain now, and I had taken a few honks on the first jug, and it was beginning to come alive. I was beginning to react to this. It was a beautiful evening. The car ran better. You've never done that, I know. And I began to sing to myself, and oh, promise me. It's just a delightful night. God was in his heaven and everything was all right. You've been in those situations with that booze. And I stopped in a little town called Cleveland, Texas, to get out and get a chaser for one of the jugs. And as I came back to the car, one of the cats got out. And I knew that I dare not come home without that damn cat. And it had begun to rain now, and it was muddy. And I was not as agile as I should be when I do not drink. And I chased this cat all over this little town about the size of Cache Creek and the mud, and finally treed him up under a cotton gin and pulled him out by his hind legs and carried him back to the car, and whipping him along, I was releasing my hostility there. And I threw him in the back of this hot automobile on that mattress, and he did a thing on that mattress that wasn't nice. It was sort of a Picasso study in brown. Do you think it bothered me? Well, certainly not. I got in, all the windows are up, the heat is going. never did it bother me for a moment. Went right on up the road singing, "Oh, Promise Me." Never missed a gear. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, I threw up in the front seat. It sickens me even to think about it now. It did not bother me one whit. I stayed in this, I like this word, I stayed in this environment until daylight. And I came to a little town called Aldo, Texas. This is one long street, about like Cache Creek, incidentally. Had a couple of street lights, and I pulled under one of the street lights to take a honk on my breakfast. And there was a town clown there, a constable or a deputy sheriff of some sort. And I guess it had been his first chance to make an arrest in a long time. And he came running out to the car, and he beat on the window and said, "Let that glass down." And he shot his head at that window, and he said, "What do you think you're, oh my God." And he slowly walked away. And I would say to you, when you put your arm around the old drunk that comes to AA, be like he is. Don't expect him to be like you. He can't come up to where you are. You have to go to where he is, because he does not know how he feels. He does not know how he feels. I'll tell you a little. I've got permission from the committee here. I'm going to talk a little bit tonight about my drinking. I think they quit doing it around AA every now and then. They say they get real nice, you know. Particularly the girls in AA. They tell their stories, and every time they tell it, it gets a little nicer. And you'd think after a while that they did all of their drinking in one room, and somebody shot it through the keyhole in an eyebrow. I'm waiting for some of them old broads I used to drink with. But every now and then somebody says, "I don't want to talk about my drink." What the hell else have you got to talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous? The book says, our stories relate in a general way what we were like. What happened? What we're like now. This is a three-faceted procedure that comes as the first instruction in Chapter 5 in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, in case you don't know about it. If I refer to the book tonight, it'll be the book Alcoholics Anonymous, that big blue one he had up here a while ago. It's about that high. There is one right here, so you'll recognize it if you ever see one. What we were like. I was born in Tyler, Texas, and had no control over that. My mother told me I was an only child. My father never would talk about it. I wonder why they call me a dirty little bastard. But, you know, I don't know about it, but anyway, when I was 17 years old, I took my first drink. I took it for the reason I suspect that a lot of people take a drink, to be accepted in a group of people. I didn't know anything about drinking. I didn't know what drinking would do to you. I knew very little about it. I was absolutely stupid in that area. But one night, there were seven of us went out and drank. And I drank right there. And that night, I got drunk before it was over with, and I passed out. I think that in alcoholism, I don't know, I heard a guy say here somewhere that he didn't remember his first drink. I think that a lot of alcoholics remember their first drink. And the reason that I think that we remember our first drink is because we're different from other people. That drink meant something to us. To take a drink meant something to us. To the non-alcoholic, it don't mean nothing. You don't even hear them explaining why they're not non-alcoholics. They ain't got nothing to explain. I had one of them skull jockeys ask me not too long ago, said, why is it that non-alcoholics don't become alcoholics? And I said, well, hell, that's easy. They ain't got no willpower. You got to be gutsy to get here. You got to be real gutsy. That night, I took a drink, and until this day, I have not been able to erase from my mind that drink. And for the next 18 and a half years, I shot at the effects of that drink. It was not compulsory. But it planted something in this fungus between my ears that has never been erased. And the momentary, the very short, temporary exhilaration that that first drink afforded me, that opened me up, God knows it turned me loose, brought me away from the wall, and let me be a part of society. For only a short few minutes, this great exhilaration happened in my life. And then I did what I did for the next 18 and a half years. I puked and passed out. And this was the story of me. I belonged to the 4-H Club down in Texas. You know what that is? That's heaves, hives, hallucinations, and hemorrhoids. I never forgot that drink. Have not forgotten it yet tonight. And I said to myself, as we geniuses usually do, that afforded me some relief. That brought me away from the wall. That let me feel a part of a situation that I could not be a part of. Removed every inhibition that I had. I drank, period, for no reason whatsoever. And then the old mind of ours that plays tricks upon us, we would create conditions that would demand the situation that would let us need to take a drink. God knows we can set the stage. It says in our book that we're the greatest actors on earth. We contrive and set up the situations to make it like this. Well, immediately Tyler got too small for me. The genius that I was, here I was an East Texas clod. And I immediately left Tyler, and of all places for me to end up was in Hollywood, California. And I chose for a profession there. I didn't really choose it. It was a fellow who chose me. I became an understudy to one of the more eminent designers of ladies' lingerie. Can you imagine a clod from East Texas? Into the hurly-burly atmosphere of Hollywood in the days of 1937 and 38. This was a very pleasurable occupation, too. I had assigned to me personally 8 models, young and beautiful. A lot of fun in that business, I'll tell you. This is where you cut these soft, silk, sleazy, intimate things that the ladies wear. Now, if any of you girls got a pinch, I've been away for a long time. You can't blame it on me. We've got a step in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the second step, where it infers that you might have a gopher in the garden. And if you cut a bunch of brassieres with 3 of them places in them, you're nuts. I told a psychiatrist about that, and he said it was just wishful thinking. Needless to say, I cut myself out of the first profession that I entered. I got fired. Wonderful opportunity. I would love to report to you that I have recently retired from my 5th profession, all of them being as a result of being an alcoholic. I've got a wonderful future behind me. I worked for a fine Jewish fellow who was one of the largest firms. I'll date myself, if you please, and use a name or two here just for the hell of it to satisfy my own ego. If you remember the actress Marlene Dietrich, in the year 1938, I put the first pair of slacks on her that women had ever been known to wear publicly and started a trend that I still see here tonight. And that was the beginning of slack suits for women. And we put them on Marlene Dietrich when she was working for Metro Goldmeyer, the firm that I did. I became a man of some consequence before they threw me out. They said I would go far in that, and I did too. One day this Jewish fellow came to me. He's a rather whimsical Jew. And the Jew will love you very much until you start tickling his pocketbook. And then he suddenly becomes undedicated to your cause. And just as though he were passing the time of day, he said to me, "You're fired." And then he laughed in kind of an aside and said to me, "I guess there's some good that comes out of everything." He said, "The way you handle those scissors, if you'd have been a rabbi, you'd have destroyed our whole race." Seems to me, and I suppose that Alcoholics Anonymous is no more or no less than what it seems to me, that the poor drunk seems to me, and I suppose that Alcoholics Anonymous is no more or no less than what it seems to me, that the poor drunk begins the progression of losing that first opportunity, then the second opportunity, and so on ad infinitum. He loses them. Pretty soon, it don't mean a lot. And it also seems to me that, like those arrows over the liquor store, the path points down. Always down. I never have seen one of us who was obsessed to drink, whose drinking improved any. Mine always improved worse. You know, the Al-Anons, they'll take up for him. They say, "How's old Joe doing?" Well, everybody knows he's a damn drunk, you know. And the poor little Al-Anon will say, "Oh, he's doing better." What she means is that your bladder is stretched. And you can sit still longer. That's all ahead of you. The poor Eladons, they lied for us and cheated for us and covered us up. And they were one of the last to admit. They knew they had a dilemma on their hands, but never would they face the situation. First job. I went out in the shipyard, and the war was going on that time, and I literally bought a plumber's license out the back door of a union hall. And I went into the shipyard as a master plumber, if you please. Here's a fellow who had never picked up anything any heavier than a pair of scissors, and I go in there, and I'm a master fraud. And those were the days, I know there's some people here old enough to remember this horrible situation, and a damn drunk cannot stand to be told he cannot do something. Don't you tell me I can't do that. I was lecturing not so long ago in the University of Illinois, and I had to do it in a big dining hall, and over on this wall over here, there was a sign hanging there. And I'd talk a little while, and then I'd go around and look at that sign. And the sign read, "Don't take the dishes out of this hall." Then I'd talk a little while, and my head would nip me. I've got two of them damn dishes at home in my den, and they have absolutely no collectible value whatsoever. But they told me don't steal them, and I just can't stand it. So I go to work for the shipyard. They got a rule. They say, "You're frozen to your job. You can't quit," they're saying to me, aren't they? And we can't stand that. We just can't stand that. I have a pink document that hangs in my den now. It is signed by the United States Department of War Labor, and it prohibits me from working within 25 miles of the city of Los Angeles. Who can't quit? Who can't quit? Don't you dare do that, they say. That's where we get off when the doctor tells us. The poor physician who don't know his ass from a bowl of honey about alcoholism. And he says to us, when condemnation, if you get drunk again, you're going to die. And we can't wait to prove. I got so damn tired of getting on that last drunk that I like to die. I really like to die. Them fellas are telling me, "If you drink again, boy, you're a goner." Why, a drunk can't stand that. We just cannot live with that sort of a rigid discipline. Our whole system is against that sort of thing. The doctor quit drinking, they said. So I got out of that. Job number two. Now, I proved that you go downhill all the way. The next job I had, I went. Have any of you ever said to your wife, "Honey, let's go somewhere else where we don't know anybody and start all over again"? You surely ain't heard that, have you? Here we go. This is the beginning of the walk. The beginning of the trip. The beginning of the added humiliations and the indignities. And the only thing wrong with the theory of moving a drunk from place A to place B is the fact that when you get there, that dirty bastard's there too. This is it. You just moving a drunk has never helped our illness very much. But I went to Northern California, and of all things, I got a job on the railroad. And I'd love to say here now, they're the most narrow-minded group of people you ever met in your life. They've got a rule about drinking. It says that if you're seen coming out of an establishment that dispenses alcoholic beverages, you can be fired. I wasn't seen coming out very often. If I came out, I was flying through the air so fast you couldn't identify me. My God. Because those folks, you know, I have breakfast every morning with a group of dingbats, a couple of lawyers and a couple of judges and an accountant or two and one banker. And this lawyer that I have breakfast with every morning represents four railroads. He's a corporate lawyer. And he laughingly says about railroad people that they're the highest paid bunch of ignorant sons of bitches he's ever seen in his life. And I go along with that. I go along with it. But I went to work for the railroad, and I'm sure they have a reason for that rule that they have, because they run more than one train on a track. You know that. I never did quite figure out how they did it. And I used to sit in the train with a watch in my hand, living in a state of horror, knowing that one day it would happen to me. I just knew it. I never did quite figure out how they got them doing this way. And I've sat with the shakes and the horrors in the back of the train with a watch in my hand and die a thousand deaths, you know, on the pure old fear of what could happen to me. Well, it did. It did. Here they go again. The railroads are like the government. They're about 20% efficient in some spots. And they hung a bulletin up in their detour. The railroad has bulletins. If they want you to do something or want to fire you for something, they'll hang a bulletin out there behind the toilet where you can't see it. And if you break the rule, they say, oh, you broke it. It's out there on the rule. You know. So they hung a bulletin in the depot in Sacramento about an interlocking system that we went through at the top of the mountain. It's where we shuffled all the helper engines. I know you know something about that around here. And this was the days of steam. And it was a very highly perfected interlocking system. And you did it inside snow sheds, and you didn't see what you were doing. You did it all by lights, and it was supposed to be automatic. Now, this railroad had the unmitigated gall to hang a bulletin up in their depot, and it read like this. It is physically impossible. Well, that gets a drunk's interest right there, don't it? It is physically impossible to make a mistake in this technically perfect interlocking system that was made by the Sperry Company, incidentally. And there again, I would go out of my way to go through the depot to read that damn bulletin. It fascinated me to death. And I'd read it on the average of twice a week. Physically impossible to make a mistake. Well, I don't know any self-respecting drunk that wouldn't have had a whack at that one. I'll tell you that. I got two engines going towards one another with four cars between them, carrots, apples, lettuce, and celery. And I made the biggest damn Waldorf salad in recorded history, I guess. Tell me I can't. And they wanted to fire me. Narrow-minded people like that. And they had an investigation. They have investigations in the railroads like they do. And you can get somebody to represent you at the investigation. And I got another drunk to represent me at this investigation. And we proved a thing that was about a million to one shot. And I only got 60 days out of it. I came out of that investigation, and the old superintendent was a big, terribly big man, weighed about 300 pounds. And he was absolutely livid with rage. He knew that he'd been had by a drunk. And he was apoplectically rage that he had. He was so red in the face. And he looked at me and he said, "You ought to be arrested for even walking on our right-of-way." And then he said a thing that some of the Al-Anons have said to their dear husbands: "I'll get you if it's the last thing I ever do." Now, did you know that you do not have to get even with the alcoholic? Did you know that there is nothing that you can call him that he hasn't called himself in the pillow at night? You don't have to get even with an alcoholic. He has something in him that, if left to his own devices, he'll ultimately get even with himself. Our dear co-founder gave us the two alternatives, or maybe one, that when obsessed to drink, unless we can find a solution to the problem, we either go mad or die. It's a picture for us. Rather terrible picture for us. I suppose that every family who has an alcoholic, and I'll change the subject now, tries everything that they can. I suppose there's not another family like mine who did not at one time stand in front of the physician. The last court they feel. They've looked up to the physician for many years for him to give them the answer to everything. And this happened in the life of me. But more than that, it happened in the life of our co-founder and his wife, Bill and Lois. And I see now Bill and Lois standing in front of Dr. Silkworth in the bust-out joint. Last chance. He's goony. Can't get sober. Dying on his feet. She's got no answer, looking for one. So they take a last shot at Dr. Silkworth. Here's the understanding of a non-alcoholic for us. Here's a man who had the experience of working with 5,000 drunks and never had a winner. All he could do was prop them up so they could lay down again, which is the ultimate use of most of the bust-out joints. Lois said to him, "What shall we do?" And he told her the same thing that the psychiatrist in San Francisco told my wife. "Nothing for you to do." "My advice for you," he said to the wife, "is to either have him locked up indefinitely or leave him and try to make a life of your own." And then he turned to Bill and probably put a thing upon him like the people put on me when they said, "You can't." He at least aroused some sort of a retaliatory ambush in Bill. Because our program shows, our 12 steps show the result
of this encounter. And he looked at Bill, and if you will hear me clearly, for a couple of sentences, he said to Bill, "You are suffering from a neurotic obsession to drink that no amount of willpower, no amount of education, or no treatment will relieve." Oh, God, did he put the pants on us. Huh? No amount of willpower, no education, or no treatment. Hey, you can't get the britches put on you any worse than that. And I bet you Bill didn't like it. I bet you Bill didn't like it. And he proved that he didn't like it. Ultimately, and I'll jump some story with the history of AA, he never forgot this. And when he constructed our 12 steps out of the 6 Oxford steps, the absolutes, he laughingly said to himself, "I've got to fix this thing where the drunk can't wiggle out." And he constructed 12 principles for the recovery of an alcoholic that do not require any willpower. They do not require any education, and they do not require any treatment. Well, I drank my way to the end. You know, it seems to me that when we drink to that last glide, whew, God, I know what it's like to get on a ski thing, you know. That last slide is the most hellish thing on earth. And I was, at that time, a lobbyist for one of the largest railroad unions in the world, the capital in Sacramento, and something happened. I don't know what it was. The fellows got against me, and the railroad got against me, and I was run out of the state of California. I'm phrasing that now very honestly. I used to say, with great dignity, that I left California a thoroughly discredited man. They ran my butt out of California. And I walked back to Texas. I hated Texas with a passion. I hated my hometown with a passion, but I had to go back. I had no other place for me to go. I had to go back. I know how, no wife, everything that I had ever held dear to me was gone. I was being hunted by that. You know, it's a funny thing to me. I went to a psychiatrist, and one of the first questions that he asked me, "Did you ever feel unwanted?" And when I came to AA, I was wanted in 2 states and not wanted in 46 others. You know. And when I got to Tyler, Lou's been down there. Tyler's not such a hot place. It was a kind of a reversal of the story of the prodigal son. They saw him coming from afar and threw his butt in jail. This was where I found myself. Here's the big shot, the resourceful man, the guy with all the answers, the kid from Beverly Hills in Hollywood, comes back home, and all the respect they showed me. My own mother had that done. Can you imagine how I hated and how filled with humiliation I felt, caged in this 5x5. Maybe we won't last for the next minute or two, because I believe I see a twinkling of our program in Alcoholics Anonymous, the very essence of what happens in AA. I'm there hating everybody. And one Monday morning, there came a fellow to my cell who I did not know and called for me by name and stood there against my will and told me all about himself. Now, that's awful humiliating, isn't it? Most of the time when people had got close to me and when they had stepped on my toes, I could spin on my heel and leave. But if you're locked up in jail, you don't spin very far. And I had to hear him out. Now, I'm going to tell you something about our Society of Alcoholics Anonymous, how the drunk dreams and how he misinterprets. I'm going to read to you the first paragraph out of Chapter 7 in the book Alcoholics Anonymous and tell you why that man came. It reads like this. The surest immunity against drinking is intensive work with other alcoholics. This works when all other activities fail. When your prayer group blows it, when your transcendental meditation group blows it, when your sitting and touching group blows it, this works when all other activities fail. And then you find a sentence in the book Alcoholics Anonymous that is followed by an exclamation mark, which denotes to me, a great English scholar that I am, it is somewhat of a command. And it says in the very next sentence, unequivocally carry this message to the other alcoholics. How are you going to interpret that? We hear guys get up in AA and say, oh, AA works by attraction rather than promotion. You better go read it again. Our public relations policy works by attraction rather than promotion. Our staying alive policy works out of the first paragraph of Chapter 7. We don't go to see alcoholics because they're alcoholics. We go to see alcoholics because we're alcoholics. And this fellow came to the jail cell to see anybody and had found my name on the blotter. And I'm so glad. He came to perpetuate his own sobriety. He had read that chapter, and that the surest immunity against drinking is intensive work with other alcoholics. This works when all other activities fail. And he had come to keep himself sober. He didn't know me. He was most unconcerned in his talk or his visit with me. But he did what he had to do to stay sober himself. And I'm so damn glad that I was standing in the right place at the right time. There are countless thousands of others who are not as lucky as I. The only question that I have to ask of Alcoholics Anonymous today is how come I was lucky enough to find it. That's all I got to ask. Everything else has been straightened out in my life. Sometimes I wake up in a cold sweat at night and think, what if that cat hadn't read that paragraph? I'd have been a dead duck. So you see, we're looking at a gift. I didn't have the privilege of making the great intellectual decision of whether I would come to AA or not. I did not sit down and deliberate and say, well, if they've got an even temperature of 70 and the soda pop machine works, I believe I'll go. I was deprived of that grave decision. This guy came and yanked me out of the jail and took me to AA. Oh, yeah. We talk ourselves out of a lot of things. Alcoholics and artists, it's self-deception. AA works by attraction rather than promotion. Wouldn't it have been a hell of a note if Bill had walked out of the Mayflower Hotel and sat on the curb and said, I'll wait till one comes by. You and I would not have been sitting in Cache Creek tonight with the privilege of belonging to Alcoholics Anonymous. With the privilege. It's not an honor to be sober. To me, it's not an honor to belong to AA. It's a privilege. Has been, and I suspect always will be. I'm so very thankful that I was standing in the right place at the right time. This eliminates my ego altogether. I can't take any credit for an hour of sobriety. Cannot take the credit for any of it. And this is the reason that this is a society and the great gift. And we'll quit now. Well, it didn't get too damn long, is it? I couldn't follow him that night. I was too full of resentment. And my people were good substantial citizens down there. And they hired two deputy sheriffs to load me into a police car and carry me to Houston to put me on a train and headed west. This is what Al-Anon euphemistically talks about when they say releasing him with love. They carried me off of that train in a wheelchair in Los Angeles and dumped me with three old bags. And for the next 5 months, I drank as few people have and lived to tell the tale. And it is only by God's grace that I come out of that flop house in Sacramento. But there was never a waking day, never a waking hour that I could erase that man from in front of me. He stood in front of me. And there's some lines in the 12 and 12 that say that it is absolutely impossible for one of us to go and share ourselves with another alcoholic. Under no conditions can he ever forget it. So, my friends, all you got to do is go. I never had... How many of you folks come in a bunch, anyway? One at a time. One at a time is the way we get here. Look at all the spiritual experiences that we have sitting here tonight. I hate the intellectually perfect description of God. I'm an alcoholic. And if I knew all there was to know about God, he might not be good enough for me. And I have to live in the elixir of the search. Always like to get there just after he's left. I like to come to Cache Creek just after he's left. See what's a handy work. This is the kind of a God. I understand that I can pick people up and set them here on a Saturday night. And I don't have to have too much explanation for God because I've seen too much he's done just before I got there. I can see it here tonight. I can see it in the eyes of every alcoholic. And there's so many things in our society that go without saying. That we can sit and look at one another and explain it away. And I came out of that flop house and went back, walked back to Tyler, Texas, 2,600 miles, to look for the guy that stood in front of that sale. And his story was the same, and he talked to me some more and rocked me to sleep as gently as a mother could handle a babe. And he took me to my first AA meeting, and I got to compare all other AA meetings with that first one. God knows, that night I was pushed up these old stairs. In those days, they were all upstairs, and I was recovering slowly from a overdose of port wine and phenobarbital, and I was kind of letting them run concurrently there. And on the night they shoved me in AA, the steps would walk around the wall, and I'd look here and see him. I don't know what happened that night in my first AA meeting. I don't remember any of the great profundities that the old dingbats said around me. I remember leaving that meeting with this feeling, and I suspect that the loss of loneliness is the greatest gift that an alcoholic can get in AA. I remember saying to myself, here are some people like me. And the sickening loneliness I suspect that haunts every drunk as long as he sits on that stool left me that night. And you have kept it from returning. Never return. I've always had you. Up until that night, I was an only one. I was convinced beyond a doubt that I was an only one who had had such a bad shuffle. And when I left that meeting that night, I said to myself, here are some people like me. I began to get well. Oh, I got well in a hurry. We'll go home here in a minute. I got to tell you this, how quick a drunk gets well. God Almighty, I knew everything there was to know about in 2 weeks. I even quit cussing. I just did everything perfectly right, letter perfect, and you might say I even became godlike. Have you ever seen any AA members who are godlike? They smell bad. I got cured of that in a hurry. I got a call to go see a drunk one night, and here I am in AA, recovered, new car, big shot, smarter than hell, know all the answers. And I go to retrieve this drunk, and all he wants is for me to retrieve his bottle. The bartender's taking it away from him. He don't do a damn thing about his problem. But I go and I take another buddy with me, and we go retrieve the drunk, and I put him between us in this nice new automobile, and I begin to give him the pitch. Oh God, did I feel good. And with sheer eloquence, I started talking to this drunk, and he's sitting between us, and as we drove slowly and I talked with curiosity, his eyes begin to water. And I thought, I'm getting him. And as we drove on with further eloquence and further curiosity, he gently lay his head over on my shoulder. And I thought, I've got him. Did you ever hear of a drunk puking silently? Every time I've ever gotten godlike with one of them, they puke on me. I don't know how long you're working with a drunk. I worked with one when I came for 4.5 years. Got him by accident. My wife took the call. I went out to see him on Sunday morning. And he was scurvy as hell like I was. And I borrowed a goblet full of whiskey and poured down him. I really knocked him out, really, is what happened. And when he kind of came unshuckled from this drink, he was in an AA club. I believe any way you can get him there is good. And he got sober under my guidance. And he stayed sober for 3 months. And then he got drunk. It didn't hurt him so much. He was used to it. But it was a hell of a blow to my ego. And I went and got him again. And I was determined that under my direction he would be sober. And this was repetitiously occurring for the next 4.5 years. And he had another affectation that I know none of you have ever had. He would go to faraway places and call me Collect. Just to tell me that he was drunk. And I prayed about him all. I'd say, God, you've been watching the sparrows too much, so let me have this one. For God's sake, give me some help. 12 years ago, he got on for him what was his last drunk in one of our local motels. And he called another fella from our group who's not half as smart as I am. And he went out and talked to that bastard for 10 minutes, and he never took another drink. I used to sit in the club and look at him and think, you ought to be mine. And if I know anything of the treasure that God gives us in this society, anything of the treasure that we receive, he gave me more than I ever gave him. He kept me sober for 4.5 years. I don't know how to be grateful enough for sobriety, for what a few minutes of it means to me when I couldn't hack it by myself. Maybe we'll go home and let me tell you a little story that don't come out of this book. It was out of another book that was written about 2,000 years ago. About a sick feller. Real sick. About a guy calling on him and about his recovery. It's a story in the scripture about a fellow they called a demoniac. And back in those days, they didn't have any psychiatrists and they didn't have any great deliberation. If we'd had him now, they'd have called him a bedwetter or catatonic or something like that. But for the lack of better verbiage, they called him a demoniac, which meant that he was a maniac full of demons. It reads in the scripture per se, it said that he was so wild that no man could tame him. Reads in the scripture per se that the manifestation of his disease, it says in there, was such that they had to keep him in fetters and chains. Kind of like me. Then it said in the scripture that his condition grew so bad that they had to run him out of town, like me. And he ended up on the riverbank. If you remember this story, eating with pigs. If you've got the imagination and the experience that I have, you have no problem in seeing this pitiful scene. Eating with pigs. The babble, the smell, and the rags. The picture of a nut. And the nut was so filled with self-pity, like we are, that he said to him, "Trouble is my name. They call me Legion, which means many. That's how much trouble I have." The little carpenter knew that he needed some help, and he didn't say to him, "Are you ready?" He effected a treatment of the nut that was as little understood in those days, possibly, as the treatment of Alcoholics Anonymous is understood today. It had to do with casting the evil spirits out of the nut and into some pigs. And the pigs were crazed and ran off down into the water and were drowned. And that's not the end of the story. There were some stool pigeons around, like there always is. And they went into town and told the people that owned these pigs. You see, in those days, the pig business was big business. And they said to the people that owned the pigs, they said to them, "You out of the pig business." And these people were real upset, just like anybody would be, if they were immediately notified they'd been put out of business. And they went in mass, it says, to see what had happened, out to the river bank. And here comes the second step of Alcoholics Anonymous. When they got there, there he sat, fully clothed and in his right mind. There he sat, fully clothed and in his right mind. These people weren't satisfied, and they prevailed upon them to leave. They got real nasty about it. They'd been out of the pig business, and they were more interested in the loss of their material pigs and the fact that one feller had got well. In Alcoholics Anonymous, that is the only thing we're interested in, is one feller getting well. And they prevailed upon him to leave, and I can see the timidity of this poor guy who has come from this hellish existence and had not had a chance to enjoy the fruits of another. And he looked at his sponsor and said to him, "Let me go with you." And the little carpenter broke a rule for us. Everybody that he'd ever helped up until this time, he had said to them, if you remember, "Go on and don't say anything about it. You were blind and now you see. Don't say a word. Keep it to yourself." But he broke a rule for us. And he said to the nut, "What I will say to you, stay here so that others can see what has happened to you. Thank you so very much."